Chapter 19. The Choice of a Patch. Elaine found Bashir pacing on the east bank of the river. Riverbanks were among the few places that still felt alive to her. So much was lifeless these days. Trees that did not put forth leaves, grass that did not grow, animals that huddled in their dens and refused to move. The rivers kept flowing. There was a sense of life to that, though the plants were dreary. The Alguenia was one of those deceptively mighty rivers that looked placid from a distance, but could pull a woman under its surface until she drowned. She remembered Bryn making a lesson of that to Gawain once, during a hunting trip they'd taken along it. He'd been speaking to her, too. Maybe to her primarily, though he'd always been careful not to overstep himself with the daughter heir. "Be careful of currents," he'd said. "River currents are one of the most dangerous things under the light, but only because men underestimate them. The surface looks still because nothing is fighting it. Nothing wants to. The fish go along with it, and men stay out of it, all except the fools who think to prove themselves." Elaine stepped down the rocky bank toward Bashir. Her guards stayed behind. Birgitta wasn't with them just now. She was seeing to the archer companies miles downriver, where they were busy pounding the trollocs building rafts to get them across the river. Birgitta's archers and Talmanis's dragons were doing an outstanding job of reducing the trolloc numbers there, but it was still only a matter of time before their vast army would pour across the Alguenia. Elaine had pulled her forces out of Andor a week before, and she and Bashir had been pleased with their progress, until they had discovered the trap. "Amazing, isn't it?" she asked, stepping up beside Bashir, who stood at the river's bank. Bashir glanced at her, then nodded.
"We don't have anything like it, back home."
"What of the Aranella?"
"It doesn't grow this big until it's outside of Saldea," he said absently. "This is almost like an ocean, settled right here, dividing bank from bank. It makes me smile, thinking of how the Aiel must have regarded it after first crossing the spine."
The two of them were silent for a time. "How bad is it?" Elaine finally asked.
"Bad," Bashir said. "I should have realized. Burn me. I should have seen."
"You can't plan for everything, Bashir."
"Pardon," he said, "but that is exactly what I'm supposed to be doing."
Their march eastward from Braem Wood had gone according to plan. Burning the bridges across the Arranin and the Alguenia, they had taken out large numbers of trollocs trying to cross after them. Elaine was now on the road that went upriver to the city of Cairhien. Bashir had planned to set up their final confrontation with the trollocs in hills along the road that lay 20 leagues south of Cairhien. The Shadow had outthought them. Scouts had spotted a second army of trollocs just to the north of their current position, marching east, heading toward the city of Cairhien itself. Elaine had stripped that city of defenders to fill out her army. Now it was filled only with refugees, and was as crowded as Camelin had been. "How did they do it?" she asked. "Those trollocs couldn't have come down from Tarwin's Gap."
"There hasn't been enough time for that," Bashir agreed.
"Another waygate?" she asked.
"Perhaps," Bashir said. "Perhaps not."
"How then?" she asked. "Where did that army come from?" "That army of trollocs was almost close enough to knock on the city gates. Light!"
"I made the mistake of thinking like a human," Bashir said. "I accounted for trolloc marching speed, but not for how the Murdral might push them. A foolish mistake. The army in the woods must have split in two, with half taking a northeastern route through the woods toward Cairhien. It's the only thing I can think of."
"We've been moving as quickly as we can," Elaine said. "How could they have overtaken us?" Her army had gateways. She couldn't move everyone through them, as she didn't have enough channelers to hold gateways for long periods. However, she could move the supply carts, the wounded, and the camp followers through. That let them march at the speed of trained soldiers.
"We've moved as quickly as we could safely," Bashir said. "A human commander would never have pushed his forces into such a terrible march. The terrain they went through had to have been awful. The rivers they had to cross, the forests, the wetlands, light. They must have lost thousands of Trollocs to fatigue during such a march. The Fades risked it, and now they have us in a pincer. The city could be destroyed as well."
Elaine fell silent. "I won't let that happen," she finally said. "Not again. Not if we can prevent it."
"Do we have a choice?"
"Yes," Elaine said. "Bashir, you're one of the greatest military minds the land has known. You have resources that no man has ever had before. The dragons, the kinswomen, Ogier willing to fight in battle. You can make this work. I know you can."
"You show surprising faith in me for someone you have known a very short time."
"Rand trusts you," Elaine said. "Even during the dark times, Bashir, when he would look at every second person around him with darkness in his eyes, he trusted you." Bashir seemed troubled.
"There is a way."
"What is it?"
"We march and hit the Trollocs near Kyrian as quickly as we can. They're tired, they have to be. If we could beat them quickly before the horde to the south reaches us, we may have a chance. It will be difficult. The northern force probably wants to seize the city, then use it against us as the southern Trollocs arrive."
"Could we open gateways into the city and hold it?"
"I doubt it," Bashir said. "Not with channelers as tired as these. Beyond that, we need to destroy the northern Trollocs, not just hold against them. If we give them time to rest, they will recover from their march, be joined by the Trollocs from the south, then use dreadlords to rip open Kyrian like an overripe apple. No, Elaine. We have to attack and crush that northern army while it is weak. Only then could we possibly hold against the southern one. If we fail, the two will smash us between them."
"It is the risk we must take," Elaine said. "Make your plans, Bashir. We'll make them work." Egwene stepped into Telairan Riod. The world of dreams had always been dangerous, unpredictable. Lately it was even more so. The grand city of Tyr reflected strangely in the dream, the buildings weathered as if by 100 years of storms. The city walls were now little more than 10 feet high, their tops rounded and smooth, blown by the wind. Buildings inside had worn away, leaving foundations and lumps of weathered stone. Chilled by the sight, Egwene turned toward the stone. It at least stood as it had, tall, strong, unchanged by the weathering of the winds. That comforted her. She sent herself into its heart. The wise ones waited for her. That, too, was comforting. Even in this time of change and tempest, they were solid like the stone itself. Amice, Bear, and Milane waited for her. She overheard part of their conversation before they noticed her.
"I saw it just as she did," Bear was saying, "though it was my own descendants who lent me their eyes. I think we will all see it now if we return the third time. It should be required."
"Three visits," Milane said.
"That brings change indeed. We still do not know if the second visit will show this or the previous vision."
Conscious of her eavesdropping, Egwene cleared her throat. They turned toward her, immediately falling silent.
"I did not mean to intrude," Egwene said, walking among the columns and joining them.
"It is nothing," Bear said. "We should have guarded our tongues. We were the ones to invite you here to meet us, after all."
"It is good to see you, Egwene Alvir," Milane said, smiling with affection.
The woman looked so far along in her pregnancy she must be close to delivering.
"From reports, your army gains much ji."
"We do well,"
Egwene said, settling herself on the floor with them. You shall have your own chance, Milane.
The Kara Khan delays, Amys said, frowning. The spears grow impatient. We should be moving against Sightblinder.
He likes to prepare and plan, Egwene said. She hesitated. I cannot remain with you long. I have a meeting with him later today.
About what? Bear asked, leaning forward, curious.
I don't know, Egwene said. I found a letter from him on the floor of my tent. He said he wanted to see me, but not as Dragon and Amerlin, as old friends.
Tell him that he must not dally, Bear said.
But here, there is something we need to speak of with you.
What is it?
Egwene asked, curious.
Have you ever seen anything like this? Milane said, concentrating.
On the floor between them, the rock split with cracks. She was imposing her will upon the world of dreams, creating something specific for Egwene to see. At first, she was confused.
Cracks in the rock?
Of course she had seen cracks in rock before. And with the earthquakes striking the land so often recently, they were probably becoming even more common.
There was something distinctive about these.
Egwene leaned forward and found that the cracks seemed to empty into nothing, a deep blackness, unnaturally so.
What is it? Egwene asked. Our people report seeing these, Amys said softly. Those fighting in Andor and those in the Blasted Lands with Randall Thor. They appear like fractures in the pattern itself. They remain dark like that for a few moments, then fade, leaving behind ordinary cracks.
It is a very dangerous sign, Bear said. We sent one of ours to ask at the Borderlands, where Lan Mandragoran fights. It appears that the cracks are most common there.
They appear more frequently when the Dreadlords fight, Amys said, when they use the weave known as Balefire.
Egwene stared at that darkness, shivering. Balefire weakens the pattern. During the War of Power, even the Forsaken grew to fear using it, lest they unravel the world itself.
We must spread the word to all of our allies, Amys said. We must not use this weave.
It is forbidden of Aes Sedai already, Egwene said. But I will make it known that nobody is to consider breaking that rule.
That is wise, Milane said. For a people with so many rules for themselves, I have found that the Aes Sedai are very proficient at ignoring guidelines if their situation allows it.
We trust our women, Egwene said. The oaths hold them. Otherwise, their own wisdom must guide them. If Moiraine had not been willing to bend this rule, Perrin would be dead. As would Matt, had Rand ignored the rule. But I will speak to the women.
Balefire bothered her. Not that it existed or did what it did. It was uniquely dangerous. And yet, what was it Perrin had said to her in the dream?
It's only another weave.
It seemed unfair that the Shadow should have access to such a weapon as this. One that unraveled the pattern as it was used. How would they fight it? How could they counter it?
This is not the only reason we sent to you, Egwene Alvear, Milane said. You have seen the changes to the world of dreams.
Egwene nodded. The storm grows worse here.
We will not be visiting here often in the future, Amys said. We have made the decision. And despite our complaints about him, the Kara Khan does prepare his armies to move. It will not be long before we march with him to the Shadow's own hold.
Egwene nodded slowly.
So this is it. I am proud of you, girl, Amys said.
Amys, tough as rocks Amys, looked teary-eyed.
They rose, and Egwene embraced them one at a time.
Light shelter you, Amys, Milane, Bear, Egwene said. Give my love to the others. It shall be done, Egwene Alvear, Bear said. May you find water and shade, now and always.
One by one they faded from Tyr. Egwene took a deep breath, looking upward. The building groaned like a ship in a tempest. The rock itself seemed to shift around her. She had loved this place, not the stone, but Telaran Riad. It had taught her so much. But she knew, as she prepared to leave, that it was like a river in dangerous flood. Familiar and loved it might be, but she could not risk herself here. Not while the White Tower needed her. And farewell to you, old friend, she said to the air. Until I dream again. She let herself wake. Gawain waited beside the bed as usual. They were back in the tower, Egwene fully dressed, in the chamber near her study. It was not yet evening, but the request from the Wise One was not something she had wished to ignore.
He's here, Gawain said quietly, glancing at the door to her study.
Then let us meet him, Egwene said. She prepared herself, rising, smoothing her skirt. She nodded to Gawain, and they stepped out and went to meet the dragon reborn. Rand smiled when he saw her. He waited inside with two maidens she did not know. What is this about? Egwene asked tiredly. Convincing me to break the seals?
You've grown cynical, Rand noted.
The last two times we met, Egwene said, you pointedly tried to infuriate me. Am I not to expect it again?
I'm not trying to infuriate you, Rand said. Look, here.
He pulled something from his pocket. A hair ribbon. He held it out to her.
You always looked forward so to being able to braid your hair.
So now you imply I'm a child? Egwene asked, exasperated. Gawain rested a hand on her shoulder, comforting.
What? No! Rand sighed. Light, Egwene, I want to make amends. You're like a sister to me. I never had siblings. Or at least the one I have doesn't know me. I only have you. Please. I'm not trying to rile you.
For a moment he seemed just as he had long ago, an innocent boy, earnest. Egwene let her frustration melt away. Rand, I'm busy. We are busy. There isn't time for things like this. Your armies are impatient.
Their time will soon come, Rand said,
growing harder.
Before this is through, they will wonder why they were so eager, and will look with longing at these restful days waiting.
He still held the ribbon in his hand, forming a fist.
I didn't want to go to my fight with our last meeting having been an argument, even if it was an important one.
Oh, Rand, Egwene said. She stepped forward, taking the ribbon. She embraced him. Light, but he'd been difficult to deal with lately. But she'd thought the same thing about her parents on occasion. I support you. It doesn't mean I'm going to do as you say with the seals, but I do support you. Egwene released Rand. She would not be teary-eyed, even if it did seem like a last parting for them.
Wait, Gawain said. Sibling? You have a sibling? I am the son of Tigraine, Rand said, shrugging. Born after she went to the waste and became a maiden.
Gawain looked stunned, though Egwene had figured this out ages ago.
You are Galad's brother? Gawain asked. Half-brother, Rand said. Not that it would probably mean much to a White Cloak. We had the same mother. His father, like yours, was Taringail, but mine was an Aiel. I think Galad would surprise you, Gawain said softly. But Elaine... Not to tell you your own family history, but Elaine is not related to me.
Rand turned to Egwene.
May I see them? The seals. Before I go to Sheol Ghul, I would look upon them one last time. I promise not to do anything with them.
Reluctantly, she fished them from the pouch at her waist, where she often kept them. Gawain, still looking stunned, walked to the window and pushed it open, letting light into the room. The White Tower felt still, silent. Its armies were gone, its masters at war. She unwrapped the first seal and handed it to Rand. She would not give him all of them at once, just in case. She did trust his word. It was Rand, after all, but just in case. Rand held up the seal, staring at it, as if seeking wisdom in that sinuous line.
I crafted these, he whispered. I made them to never break. But I knew as I did it that they would eventually fail. Everything eventually fails when he touches it.
Egwene hefted another of the seals, holding it gingerly. It would not do to break the thing by accident. She kept them wrapped and the pouch stuffed with cloth. She worried about breaking them while carrying them, but Moiraine had indicated that Egwene would break them. She felt that was foolish, but the words she had read, the things Moiraine had said, well, if the moment did come to break them, Egwene would need to have them at hand, and so she carried them, carried with her the potential death of the world itself. Rand suddenly went as white as a sheet.
Egwene, he said, this does not fool me.
What doesn't? He looked at her.
This is a fake. Please, it is all right. Tell me the truth. You made a copy and gave it to me.
I did nothing of the sort, she said.
Oh. Oh, light.
Rand raised the seal again.
It's a fake.
What? Egwene snatched it from his hand, feeling it. She sensed nothing wrong. How can you be sure?
I made them, Rand said. I know my handiwork. This is not one of the seals. It is light. Someone took them.
I've had these with me each moment since you gave them to me, Egwene said.
Then it happened before, Rand whispered. I didn't look them over carefully after I fetched them. He knew somehow where I'd put them.
Taking the other one from her, he shook his head.
It's not real either.
He took the third.
Nor this one.
He looked at her.
He has them, Egwene. He's stolen them back somehow. The Dark One holds the keys to his own prison.
For much of Matt's life, he had wished that people would not look at him so much. They gave him frowns at the trouble he had ostensibly caused, trouble that really was not his fault, and glances of disapproval when he walked about completely innocent, trying his best to be pleasant. Every boy filched a pie now and then. No harm in it. It was practically expected. Normal life had been harder for Matt than for other boys. For no good reason, everyone watched him extra carefully. Perrin could have stolen pies all day, and people would have just smiled at him and maybe mussed his hair. Matt, they came at with the broom. When he entered a place to dice, he drew looks. People watched him as they would watch a cheater, though he never was, or with envy in their eyes. Yes, he had always figured that not being watched would be a grand situation, a cause for real celebration. Now he had it, and it made him sick. You can look at me, Matt protested. Really? Burn you, it's all right. My eyes would be lowered, the serving woman said, as she piled fabric on the low table against the wall. Your eyes are already lowered. They're staring at the bloody floor, aren't they? I want you to raise them. The Shonchan continued her work. She was of fair skin, with freckles under her eyes, not too bad to look at, though he was more in favor of darker shades these days. He still would not have minded if this girl showed him a smile. How could he talk to a woman if he could not try to make her smile? A few other servants entered, eyes downcast, carrying other folds of fabric. Matt stood in what were apparently his chambers in the palace. They were more numerous than he would ever need. Perhaps Telmanis and some of the band could move in with him and keep the place from feeling so empty. Matt sauntered over to the window. Below, in the Molhara, an army organized. It was going to take longer than he wanted. Galgan, Matt had only met the man briefly, and he did not trust the fellow, no matter what Tuan said about his assassins not being intended to succeed, was gathering the Shan-Chan forces from the borders, but too slowly. He worried about losing Almuth Plain with the withdrawal. Well, he had better listen to reason. Matt had little reason to like the man already, but if he delayed in this...
"Honored one?" the serving girl asked.
Matt turned, raising an eyebrow. Several Dakovale had entered with the last of the fabric, and Matt found himself blushing. They hardly wore any clothing at all, and what they did wear was transparent. He could look, though, could he not? They would not wear clothing like that if a man was not supposed to look. What would Tuon think? "She doesn't own me," Matt thought, determined. "I will not be husbandly." The freckled servant, she was Sojin, half of her head shaved, gestured toward a person who had entered behind the Dako veil, a middle-aged woman with her dark hair in a bun, none of her head shaved. She was squat, shaped kind of like a bell, with a grandmotherly air. The newcomer inspected him. Finally, someone who would look at him. If only her face did not have the expression of one studying horses at the market.
"Black for his new station," the woman said, clapping her hands once. "Green for his heritage, a deep forest in moderation. Someone bring me a variety of eye patches, and someone else burn that hat."
"What?" Matt exclaimed. Servants swarmed around him, picking at his clothing.
"Wait now, what is this?" "Your new regalia, honored one," the woman said. "I am Nata, and I will be your personal tailor."
"You aren't burning my hat," Matt said. "Try, and we'll bloody well see if you can fly from four stories up. Do you understand me?" The woman hesitated.
"Yes, honored one. Do not burn his clothing. Keep it safe, should it be needed."
She seemed doubtful it ever would be. Matt opened his mouth to complain further, and then one of the Dako Vale opened a box. Jewelry shone inside it. Rubies, emeralds, fire drops. Matt's breath caught in his throat. There was a fortune in there. He was so stunned that he almost did not notice that the servants were undressing him. They pulled at his shirt, and Matt let them. Although he held on to his scarf, he was not bashful. That blush on his cheeks had nothing to do with his trousers being taken off. He was just surprised at the jewelry. Then one of the young Dako Vale reached for Matt's small clothes. "You'd be real funny without any fingers," Matt growled. The Dako Vale looked up, his eyes widening, face paling. He immediately looked down again, bowing, backing away. Matt was not bashful, but the small clothes were far enough. Nata clicked her tongue. Her servants began draping Matt in fine cloth, black and deep green, so dark it was nearly black itself.
"We shall tailor you outfits for military expression, court attendance, private functions, and civic appearances. It..."
"No," Matt said. "Military only."
"But..."
"We're at the bloody last battle, woman," Matt said. "If we survive this, you can make me a bloody feast day cap. Until then, we're at war, and I don't need anything else." She nodded. Matt reluctantly stood with arms out to the sides, letting them drape him in the fabric, taking measurements. If he had to put up with this business of being called Honored One and Highness, then he could at least make certain he was dressed in a reasonable way. In truth, he had been growing tired of the same old clothing. There did not seem to be much lace used by the Shan-Chan tailor, which was a shame, but Matt did not want to correct her in doing her job. He could not complain about every little thing. Nobody liked a complainer, least of all Matt. As they dealt with the measurements, a servant approached with a small velvet-lined case displaying a variety of eye patches.
He hesitated, considering. Some were marked with gemstones, others painted with designs. "That one," he said, pointing at the least ornamented patch. Simple black, with only two small rubies, cut thin and long, set at the right and left edges of the patch opposite one another. They fitted it on him as the other servants finished measuring. That done, the tailor had her servants dress him in a costume she had brought. Apparently, he was not going to be allowed back to his old clothing while he waited for his new outfits to be tailored. The clothing started off simple enough, a silk robe of fine weave. Matt would have preferred trousers, but the robe was comfortable. However, they overlaid it with a larger, stiffer robe. It was also silk, of dark green, every inch of it embroidered with scrollwork patterns. The sleeves were large enough to trot a horse through, and they felt heavy and bulky. "I thought I said to give me warrior's clothing," he said.
"This is a ceremonial warrior's uniform for a member of the Imperial Family, Highness," Nata said. "Many will see you as an outsider, and though nobody would question your loyalty, it would be well for our soldiers to see you as Prince of the Ravens first, and an Outlander second. Would you agree?"
"I suppose," Matt said. The servants continued, buckling on an ornate girdle and placing forearm bands of the same design on his arms inside the large sleeves. That was all right, Matt supposed, as the girdle pulled in the waist of the clothing and kept it from feeling quite so bulky. Unfortunately, the next piece of clothing was the most ridiculous of all. The stiff, pale piece of cloth fitted onto his shoulders. It draped down his front and back like a tabard, the sides open, but they flared out to the sides a good foot each, making him seem inhumanly wide. They were like shoulder plates from heavy armor, only made of cloth.
"Here now," Matt said. "This isn't a kind of trick you play on a fellow just because he's new, is it?"
"Trick, honored one?" Nata asked.
"You can't really..." Matt trailed off as someone passed outside his door. Another commander. The man was wearing a costume not unlike Matt's, though not as ornate, and with shoulders not quite as wide. Not Imperial Family armor, but ceremonial armor for one of the blood. Still, it was almost as lavish. The man stopped and bowed to Matt, then continued on his way.
"Burn me," Matt said.
Nata clapped, and the servants began draping Matt in gemstones. They chose mostly rubies, which made Matt uncomfortable. That had to be a coincidence, did it not? He did not know what he thought of being covered in all of these gemstones. Perhaps he could sell them. Actually, if he could put these on a gambling table, he could probably end up owning all of Ebu Dar. Tuan already owns it, he realized. And I married her. It sank in that he was rich. Really rich. He sat there, letting them lacquer his nails as he considered what this all meant. Oh, he had not needed to worry about money for some time, as he could always gamble for more. This was different. If he already had everything, what point was there to gambling? This did not sound like much fun. People were not supposed to give you things like this. You were supposed to find a way to come to them yourself, by wits, luck, or skill.
"Burn me," Matt said, lowering his arms to his side as the lacquering finished. "I'm a bloody nobleman."
He sighed, plucking his hat from the hands of a startled servant, who was walking past with his old clothing, and set it on his head.
"Honored one," Nata said. "Please forgive my forwardness, but it is my place to advise you on fashion, if you please. That hat looks particularly out of place with that uniform."
"Who cares?" Matt said, marching out of the room. He almost had to go out the door sideways. "If I'm going to look ridiculous, I might as well do it with style. Someone point me toward where our flaming generals are meeting. I need to figure out how many troops we have."